Okay. Thanks so much for the wonderful introduction. I tried to be extremely funny. I will tell you about ultra-cold Fermi gases and what they do when you smash them into each other. That's usually what physicists love to do when they have some new stuff. They just smash it into itself and see what happens. That's what we did here, where we have a blue cloud. Blue could be spin up, could be some hyperfine states. You can just call it blue cloud bouncing into a red cloud of fermions. And fermions, as we will see, are the guys that really, you know, they don't like to be together. So clearly here they repel each other in a dramatic way. Two gases a million times thinner than air repel. So that's completely bizarre. I have to tell you more to make this image a little bit easier to digest. Let me first bring everyone on the same page, namely the temperature scale that we are talking about. We all know that we don't want to be in a supernova explosion because it is very hot, 10 to the 9 Kelvin. In fact, we probably have been there about 3 times or so because only there we can get these heavy elements that we are made out of. So, but we were not in one piece, very clearly. So that was uncomfortable. If you go 3 orders of magnitude lower, it's still pretty hot. That's the center of the sun. Still not nice. You love to sit here in your living room at room temperature. So on the Kelvin scale, it's called a 300 Kelvin. Now we go into outer space that is, again, uncomfortable, a few Kelvin. We are, with ultra-cold atoms, way down here. It's another 10 to the 12 orders of magnitude away from your living room in the nano-Kelvin regime, and much further away on the logarithmic scale than the supernova explosion is on the hot side of that scale. So it's very impressive how far away we are from a normal happy regime. To compare, like, what is temperature? Temperature is, of course, a measure of the average velocity of the particles in your system. It's a measure of the energy content of your system. So it's interesting to look at the velocity that you have if you're riding on a supernova explosion. It's so fast, a million meters per second, that you make it to Paris in 10 seconds, which is great. Not in one piece, but you make it. And at room temperature, the particles that are right now bouncing off your chin or cheek, they are running around at several hundred meters per second, the speed of an airplane. It's actually rather impressive. At very low temperatures, where we work in the ultra-cold regime, atoms move at a snail's speed. They make maybe a millimeter per second, and that's it. So it's really extremely slow. Now you might think that is a bit boring, you know, just slowing down the motion of these atoms. If that's all we do, that would not be very interesting. But turns out, at some point, quantum mechanics takes center stage as we cool down the gas. And the reason is the following. Particles here, like all kinds of billiard balls maybe, in the air, do behave as waves, as we learned. Waves that have a certain extent, a certain wavelength, or you could also call it the uncertainty with which we know where the particles are, delta x. And we have learned from De Broglie that as you lower the temperature of a gas or so, the velocity goes down. So I know much better what the average velocity, what the velocity uncertainty is of my particles, but I know much less where the particles are, so the uncertainty in its position grows. And at some point, you see, we get into trouble when all these waves start to overlap and touch each other, then quantum mechanics must take center stage. At this point, we have to know one more thing to predict what will happen now. We have to know that there are two different sorts of particles in the universe, only two, it's not so hard. It's the bosons and the fermions. And fermions are clearly these antisocial particles that each occupy a single energy state in your system, whatever that might be. So this guy is, for example, asleep. This guy is listening to music, very antisocial. This guy is probably even spying on the others. And this guy for the experts is probably Pauli blocking himself. So very antisocial, guys. Whereas the bosons, they love to be together. They love to all gather in the ground state. They even love to help each other into the ground state. That's bosonic stimulation. And form a Bose-Einstein condensate. All atoms, say in our systems, 10 million atoms in the same quantum mechanical state. So these are the happy particles, you might say, and these are the sad ones, and so we should work with these guys. But there are ways in which we can make the fermions happy, and that will be what this talk is about. This now is the cartoon to finish this sequence from hot to cold. This would be the finishing cartoon picture for the boson side of things. All the bosons will occupy one and only one macroscopic wave function at zero temperature, whereas fermions in this cartoon sense, they have to stay apart. They have to all be in their own wave and not touch each other. What is the characteristic temperature we have to reach? Well, we saw that we have to make sure that the uncertainty, the quantum mechanical uncertainty with which we know where each particle is, that must grow to the distance, to the interparticle distance in your gas. Because then these wave packets start to touch, and we are in the situation that we have to worry whether these guys are bosons or fermions, whether the waves just all overlap, or whether they have to stay apart. So this is the characteristic uncertainty where this will happen. And I know from de Broglie that the uncertainty is given by H bar, or Heisenberg, one of the two, H bar divided by the uncertainty in the momentum. And the uncertainty momentum is related to the temperature. So I can figure out what the temperature is, the temperature scale, and we just did that in class. So those guys who were there still know. This is the formula that I derived in class. What is the degeneracy temperature you have to reach in order to get into this interesting regime where the wave functions start to touch? Einstein figured that out, by the way. He realized that at this temperature, about there, you would form this Bose-Einstein condensate. By the way, this temperature scale, at zero temperature, it's still an important energy scale if you work with fermions. Because fermions, even at zero temperature, they have to stay apart. They still have to have this distance between the wave packets. So the wave packets are confined to roughly the interparticle spacing. So you can figure out that the energy content of this Fermi gas at zero temperature is still given by the same expression. So that now gives us an energy scale that I can again plot here on a temperature axis and now compare different systems that are degenerate. So if you ever wanted to touch a degenerate system with your hands, you just grab your next metal piece and you hold in your hand a wonderful degenerate gas of electrons, turns out. Because electrons, they have a Fermi temperature, characteristic temperature E Fermi, because of their very low mass and their high density, which is many 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So at room temperature, this electron gas that I'm holding here is actually very degenerate. So we're done. Perfect. That's easy. There are astronomical objects where I have degenerate gases, for example, white dwarfs, where you have electrons. These guys are pretty much held together only because of the fermionic nature of the electrons that are sitting in here. They're super heavy, so you might think gravity should make them collapse to a point. But precisely because the electrons don't want to overlap, because they're fermions, these white dwarfs have a finite size. They do not shrink to a point. And it's even more dramatic for neutron stars. Those are so heavy that the electrons were squeezed into the protons, forming neutrons, and you're left with only neutrons in this thing, apart from some protons that are still swimming around, mostly neutrons, that are squeezed together by gravity, but held against further collapse just by the fact that they are fermions. Neutrons are also fermions. Actually, any massive elementary particle is a fermion, because every elementary particle that has a mass turns out to have half-integer spin, if that helps someone. That's the formal definition. If these guys have half-integer spin, then they're fermions. So this neutron star, maybe 10 miles in diameter, it has a mass of more than the mass of our sun, all squeezed together, but the reason that it's not zero in size is precisely because the neutrons don't want to overlap. Down here we have liquid helium. If you cool helium down, at some point it will actually turn into a liquid and it will not solidify. That's the special thing about helium. It will stay a liquid, and at very low temperatures, the waves that these helium particles should be described as, they also overlap, and the gas becomes a degenerate liquid, helium liquid, which even becomes a superfluid at low temperatures. It flows without any friction. Cold atoms work, become degenerate in the microkelvin regime. So that's, again, quite far away from our metal here that we hold in our hands. It's 10 to the 6 orders of magnitude cold, actually up to 10 to the 9. That's where we live. How do we get to these low temperatures? There are two techniques, and they would fill, each of them could fill easily a lecture or something like that. So unfortunately, I don't have time to go into the greatest detail, but it's beautiful. The first one is laser cooling, which is the fact that atoms love to absorb light, right? For example, sodium atoms, you know very well what light they like to absorb. It is yellow, orangey yellow. You know this from the street lamps. They're actually sodium street lamps. At least in the US, they use them. Do you use them here as well? Orangey kind of street lamps. Yes. Beautiful. That's sodium. Yeah. So sodium loves to absorb and emit in the yellow. And if you shine in a laser beam onto a sodium cloud, the sodium atom will absorb the photon, the light particle, which carries momentum. So it gets a kick, just as from a billiard ball, and it slows down. And of course, you would repeat this over and over again and slow down the atom to very low velocities. With this laser cooling, you can get to a millikelvin if you don't sweat. If you work hard, you can get even into the microkelvin regime, but there is some limit. So you have to do one more step. You have to invent another technique, and that's simply what we all do to our coffee. That's actually happening right now to my coffee. Evaporative cooling. The hot coffee particles go away, and the low energetic coffee particles remain and rethermalize, and the coffee gets colder. Then I can even speed that up by blowing on my coffee. That's called forced evaporative cooling, which we do to our atoms in the trap as well. We remove selectively the high energetic ones, and the low energetic ones remain and rethermalize. That method is very powerful. It gets us to, well, arbitrarily low temperatures, with the one catch that we keep losing particles as we blow on the coffee. So since you don't want to end up with one or zero atoms, we have to stop at some point, and typically in the lab every day we get 10 nanokelvin rather easily, working with 10 million atoms. This is a look onto one of our vacuum chambers, where in the center you see this glowing ball of atoms. Those are laser-cooled potassium atoms, roughly 10 billion of them. It's potassium 39. Glowing so beautifully because these atoms not only absorb the light, of course, but they also have to spit it out again via spontaneous emission. And so that's why you see it so beautifully. I should admit that your eye would see it much less beautifully than this infrared camera, than this camera, which is sensitive in the infrared. But if you work with sodium, for example, it's beautiful. You have this orangey-yellow glow in the middle of your chamber. You can look at it, and it's just breathtaking. 10 billion atoms at roughly a millikelvin. There to look at. It's beautiful. We need one more ingredient to make physics interesting. Physics is all about interactions in the end. If you have no interactions, it's a little bit simple to describe the system, so you want to switch on strong interactions. And there's a wonderful magic tool that we have in ultra-cold atoms, which is called a Feshbach resonance. A Feshbach resonance works as follows. Usually, when two atoms come, they meet, they might collide, okay, leave again, but this collision is usually a weak process. Usually, this doesn't perturb the waves that we should think of these particles as being. It doesn't perturb them much. It just shifts them a little bit, but that's it. However, if the atoms realize, wait a second, there is a molecular state available to us, and it's not so far away in energy, then they can populate this molecular state for a while until they maybe realize, oh, we don't quite have the right energy to stay in that state, so let's leave again. It's obvious that the best thing to do is to put this molecular state right into resonance with two free atoms, because then, well, that's a resonance in quantum mechanics. You bring two levels in resonance to each other, then you can spend a long time in this molecular state and they will interact as strongly as nature allows. So that trick we can actually do in the lab. You simply need a molecular state that has a different magnetic moment than the magnetic moment of two free atoms. So it will experience a different Zeeman shift in a magnetic field. Remember, the Zeeman shift is just the magnetic moment times the magnetic field. So we will shift the molecular state up and make it resonant with the energy of two free atoms at a certain magnetic field. And that's when the scattering between the two atoms will be as strong as possible. The interaction strength shown by this red line will be as strong as nature allows. It diverges. It even goes through infinity and comes back at minus infinity. What I'm drawing here for the experts is the scattering length that describes this quantum mechanical scattering process. So that's fantastic. Here the interactions are as strong as we can ever wish and hope for, and that's why the systems that we can study are very non-trivial and interesting to study. So those interactions get us into what is called many-body quantum mechanics. What happens when you bring many particles together and have them interact under some strong interaction, and then new things happen that the individual particles wouldn't do on their own. You need the many-particle physics. For example, of course, you can form nuclei, very strongly interacting systems of many particles. That these guys are small, though, hard to study. You need lots of energy to study them. We have talked about the white dwarfs, also interesting many-body systems, but they're far away, also hard to study. There are very intriguing objects that you can very nicely study in the lab. They are just human-sized, high-TC superconductors, or superfluid helium, but they're very, very difficult to understand. It would be great if you had a better understanding of high-TC superconductors, because maybe we could build a room-temperature superconductor that would allow us to transport energy without any cost, without any heating, from A to B. But we don't quite know what's going on here. So that's where ultra-cold atoms can now come in, as relatively easily accessible and widely tunable quantum systems, many-body quantum systems, where we can tune not only the interactions, but also, for example, the geometry of these clouds of atoms. We can, for example, chop them into pancakes or tubes, or even put them as single points on a big optical lattice and therefore mimic what's going on with electrons in a crystal lattice. So with those guys, we can realize, as I will show you, in fact, in this talk, what Feynman would have called a quantum simulator. You have some complicated quantum problem involving many, many quantum particles. You need a quantum computer to solve that problem, which we don't have, so that's a problem. But the way out is to take another quantum system, like our atoms, and mimic this more complicated system using these atoms and just read off what nature provides as the answer of this complicated calculation, if you want. So we are using a quantum system to mimic other quantum systems for which we don't know the answer yet. And that's pretty cool. Eventually, we would love to have a quantum computer, and we will. Let's just wait. We'll have it at some point. But so far, it's fantastic to simply use quantum particles that we can have in our experiment and see what nature says. I will now tell you about a few experiments that we did to illustrate what we can do with these ultra-cold atoms. One strength of cold atoms is real-time dynamics. In electron systems, of course, things happen on the picosecond scale or even faster, so it's very, very hard to catch the system and see it evolve. With cold atoms, you can make movies. Everything is slow. The gas is very dilute, and therefore all the processes, all the energy scales are very, very low, and that means slow. And so we can take movies of time-dependent problems, and I will show you this spin transport example. And then I will also tell you about thermodynamics and how we can directly get the equation of state of these interesting gases and find the superfluid transition in these gases. And then I will talk about novel Fermi systems, one example of which is this weird spin-orbit coupled gas. Might not have time to go into details, but I can tell you roughly where we are headed. So let's start with the first example, the non-equilibrium story. As I said, physicists love to shoot things at other things and bang them together, and we do this at best at the LHC right now. There you can collide, for example, heavy nuclei, gold-gold or lead-lead nuclei into each other, shabam, and out comes a mess of particles, but out of this mess you can recreate what weird fluid was there in the beginning of the universe. And what is created in these strong heavy ion collisions is a quark gluon plasma, as it's called. A mess, a strongly interacting soup of quarks held together by gluons. It's extremely hard to understand in detail, but macroscopically it just behaves as a very, very good liquid. Just a very, very good fluid, and it will have a relation to what we have in the lab in ultra-cold atoms. This is a view of the inside of the LHC that you must have seen many times. There's a little person here inside a huge accelerator cross-section. This now is our cold atom lab, where you also see it's equally messy. There is a small person here sitting on the camera. Turns out I'm, of course, cheating. This here is 4 feet. But we do use this person sometimes to reach this mirror up here. Very, very handy because we cannot reach there with our hands. So it's very useful to have him. You see, it's fun. I mean, we have lots of lasers. Here you see some red glow, some yellow glow for laser cooling of sodium and lithium. We also see some green glare in the background that we will need in a moment. So it's fun. And a few grad students can really explore new things about matter with strong interactions. So that's really nice about these experiments. If you want to visit a lab like this, you just go down to Joseph Stuyvesant's lab. Looks a little bit more modern than our crazy stuff, but pretty much is, you know, crazy. Yeah, sorry, I have to say. That's what our cold atom experiments turn out to be. This is like unbelievable. It's beautiful. So now, with that apparatus, we build what I like to call the little Fermi collider, LFC, clearly, which is a spin-down Fermi gas that collides with a spin-up cloud. I should tell you what I mean by spin-down and spin-up. In reality, it's a hyperfine state of the lithium atom. Hyperfine states is this combination of electron spin and nuclear spin. But for you, if you like, it could be just red and blue or spin up and spin down. It doesn't matter. These guys, we will collide with the strongest interaction possible in nature, which in our case means a collision at 100 picoelectron volts. That's not a lot. It's actually 23 orders of magnitude smaller than what we can do in the LHC. Unfortunately, it's not 23 orders of magnitude cheaper. It's getting there, but not quite. This system is still in a harmonic trap. So these clouds, if you don't have any interactions, they should just pass through each other, come back, pass through each other, come back, etc. That's what should happen. And we should see this now in this experiment, where we switch off any interactions between blue and red. So we will see, not very surprising. They just trade places, move through each other, and that's it. What I'm showing here is the we took absorption images of these two clouds, and we can separately image blue and red, and then I subtracted the two images. Yes, luckily. So spin up and spin down are separated in energy by 80 megahertz times H, which is Planck's constant. And the natural line width of the transition is much smaller than that. So I can select which one I want to image next. These are the frames of the movie, which, it looks beautiful, right? But it's really, nothing happens, right? Nothing happens. They just pass through each other. It looks fantastic, but that's it. Now let's switch on the strong interactions, resonant interactions. Blue and red, on collision course, what happens? Shabam. Yeah, I call it the shabam. Where these guys, these two clouds, a million times thinner than air, bounce into each other like two cars in a car crash. Bounce back. Yeah? So they cannot pass through each other, it looks like. And we didn't believe this would happen. So we thought, like, of course they should go through each other, million times in the air. But they bounced off each other. So we were super surprised in front of the computer sitting there. Why is the spin-up cloud always on the left side of the screen and the spin-down cloud always on the right side? They bounce off each other. It's crazy. Here's the difference density as a function of time, the frames of the movie that you've already seen. So that's what you saw on the title slide. Here's the total density. Just sum up the red and the blue. And you see in the center where they collide, the density piles up like mad to very high values because they really don't want to be on top of each other. They rather form this huge mountain and then part again. This shows now the evolution after more time. So this thing here, this first collision, that shows the first bounce. And I'm showing here the center of mass of the red and the blue cloud. This is the red cloud, the blue cloud. And they bounce a couple of times. Remember, they're still in this harmonic trap. So they come back, bounce, 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 bounce. And after some while, 200 milliseconds or so, the bounces have stopped. But you see, they are still not overlapped. You need to wait 1 second until they really overlap, these two clouds, spin up and spin down. So you get, still after half a second, an image where you have mostly spin up on one side and spin down still on the other side. There's still a magnetization, if you want, in this gas. So why is that? Well, it's the strongest interaction that quantum mechanics allows. So that means the mean free path for a collision between a spin down and a spin up particle is as short as it can possibly be. The shortest mean free path is just one interparticle spacing. That simply means at each encounter, the spin down guy has to scatter with the spin up guy every time. That's very different from the air particles in our air right now. If I throw an air particle around, it takes many interparticle spacings until it actually decides to scatter with a guy. If you now figure out the diffusion constant to see how slow they diffuse into each other, the diffusion constant is just the mean free path times the average velocity. The mean free path is the interparticle spacing. The average velocity, let's remember Heisenberg or de Broglie, whomever you like, is given by h bar over m times the interparticle spacing. So the interparticle spacing cancels out beautifully, and you're left with a universal diffusion coefficient, h bar over m. That's pretty cute. H bar over m is a diffusion coefficient. It's Planck's constant divided by the particle mass. That is called the quantum limit of diffusion. And if you plug in the mass of a lithium atom, turns out we get 100 microns squared per second. That's the right units of a diffusion coefficient. And that makes sense because our clouds, I didn't tell you, they're roughly 100 microns large in length, and it takes 1 second for them to diffuse into each other. So we are in this limit of h bar over m. By the way, this is actually related to what happens in a quark-gluon plasma. People predicted that the diffusion coefficient in a quark-gluon plasma should be h bar c squared over the temperature. How is that related to our non-relativistic gas? Well, we should just replace our mass, which is not observable at ultra-relativistic temperatures, mc squared, by the kinetic energy. Ultra-relativistic, you don't see the mass of the particles anymore. You're left with just the kinetic energy, so T. Once you plug that in, you get the formula for a quark-gluon plasma out of our H bar over M formula for the non-relativistic gas. So then we went through some pain to actually measure the diffusion coefficient as a function of temperature carefully by watching the gas mix as a function of temperature. And we see at high temperatures, we lie on a curve that is predicted by a simple classical theory, where still the interactions are as strong as quantum mechanics allows, but it's still a classical gas. Whereas at low temperatures, we see we completely depart from the classical behavior, which would be this line here, and we flatten out to a limiting value. This is the quantum limit of spin diffusion. We find out that it's 6 times h bar over m in our trapped system. Okay, that's what it is. And it might actually go up again. There are very, very good reasons why at very low temperatures the diffusion coefficient can go up again, should go up again. We can talk about that at the end. That's what should happen. Unfortunately, the error bars get larger for reasons I can also tell you about later. So now I want to calm the system down. I don't want to do this violent spin up into spin down smash. I want to mix spin up and spin down very calmly, beautifully, cool the gas down. Don't inject any further energy, but just see what happens. And we know that fermions, spin up and spin down fermions, they can actually form effectively bosons. They can form pairs, Cooper pairs, that we know from superconductors. So this should happen also in our ultra-cold Fermi gas. Spin up and spin down should pair up. In fact, these bosons here, on the boson side of the story, that form a Bose-Einstein condensate, if you're honest, they're also fermion pairs, right? A hydrogen atom is an electron glued to a proton, two fermions glued to each other, forming a boson. A sodium atom is a sodium ion glued to an electron, so that's also formed out of two fermions. So over here on the fermion side of things, I also need two species of fermions, red and blue, and we know from Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer that for the weakest interaction between the reds and the blues, there will also be pairs forming, Cooper pairs, and this gas can then also form a superfluid. There's one catch. Bose-Einstein condensation occurs at this degeneracy temperature, or Fermi temperature, that we figured out in the beginning of the talk, and we learned since 1995 how to reach that temperature. However, fermions, they become superfluid only once the pairs have formed. You first need the bosons, then you can hope to condense them. And unfortunately, this pairing is a weak effect for small interactions. And A, that was, remember, the scattering length, which determined the interaction strength. If A is very small, e to the minus 1 over A is very, very, very small, exponentially small, actually. And you get a critical temperature for this pairing and superfluidity, which is unattainable. It's completely out of reach, 10 to the minus 10 times this temperature scale. Luckily, with the Feshbach resonances, you saw that I can make A, the scattering length, go through the roof, make it infinity. That makes actually this exponential factor close to 1. And then I don't need to do much. I already know since 1995 how to reach temperatures on the order of the Fermi temperature, and I will see a superfluid of fermions. So it's crucially the Feshbach resonances that have allowed us to do that. So we thought we had a superfluid. What do we do to prove that it's a superfluid? We do the rotating bucket experiment. If you have your cup of coffee and you want to figure out whether it's superfluid or not, you should rotate it. Because a boring cup of coffee, which is normal, would just show, well, there's meniscus, which is kind of cute, right? But other than that, it's a classical fluid. A quantum fluid is described by a macroscopic wave function. The only way a wave function can rotate is by developing these peculiar mini tornadoes, vortices that pierce through the bucket of coffee. And if you see that, then you know, oh, wow, I have a superfluid cup of coffee, and you can publish, right? From the top of your bucket, the vortices should arrange themselves in this beautiful apricose of lattice that apricose figured out. Turns out he thought it was a square lattice first, and then later people figured out there's a tiny, tiny glitch in the calculation. There's a very small energy difference between the square lattice and the triangular lattice, and, well, he had some minus sign wrong or something. Turns out it's a triangular lattice. That's the best arrangement of these mini tornadoes in three dimensions. They want to be as closely packed as possible while still not being on top of each other. So that was the goal, to prove that we had made a superfluid of these fermion pairs. So we took our cloud, put it in this laser trap, which is this pink large beam here, and we switched on our magnetic fields to reach this Feshbach resonance to make the interactions very strong and hopefully have them pair up. And then we took further laser beams, this green stuff here, these green laser beams as an effective spoon to rotate our cup of coffee. Really, that's actually what we did. We used these lasers to rotate our cloud of atoms. And the hope was that as we now open up the trap, let the gas fly out, if we now take an absorption image, so we take a laser beam that shines onto the cloud, the atoms absorb the light, then on our CCD camera we should see beautiful white patches where the light passed through the cloud amidst of this dark shadow of the atoms that are not in the vortices. So this would have shown directly the vortices. So that was what we were after. So we did this experiment. Here's our cloud. I inverted black and white so it looks cooler. We take a laser beam, two in fact, just to rotate symmetrically, it's not so important. rotate it around a couple of times in PowerPoint, and wait a bit, and out comes indeed a beautiful apricot of lettuce, of vortices. So that proved to us these guys, these fermions, have paired up. They have formed a macroscopic meta wave of pairs, and these pairs are superfluid. This works in the regime where the pairs are very small. A lithium atom is glued to a lithium atom and forms a boson. But it also works in a regime where there is no such molecular pairing, and it's much rather the description of BCS, Barding, Cooper, and Schrieffer, where the pairs are larger, long range. Okay, there was one embarrassing detail about this experiment. We had no idea what the temperature was. No idea is a little exaggerated. We knew it was like 10 or 20, maybe 30% of the Fermi temperature, but we didn't quite know what the temperature was exactly. The reason was, well, we cannot stick in a thermometer, right? That's clear. The other thing is, you might think, oh, let's just expand the gas and see how quickly it expands, and that tells us how fast the atoms are, and that tells us what the velocity is. Great, that's what the temperature is. That doesn't work because these are fermions, and even at zero temperature, they would still fly out with a characteristic energy given by the Fermi energy, which is huge. So just looking at how fast they are doesn't tell us how cold they are. So we didn't have a thermometer. And actually, only last year, we figured out how to do a very good job in this thermometry. And the goal was to get the equation of state of these gases, the pressure as a function of density and temperature. And we all know this equation. We all love it. That's the classical equation of state for a non-interacting gas. We love it, grow up with it. But then for a strong interacting Fermi gas, there must be also an equivalent equation of state relating the pressure to the density and the temperature. So that's what we were after, and I will tell you now how we got that equation of state. It's not just an academic question that interests us working with these ultra-cold atoms, but it turns out it's of high interest to people trying to describe neutron stars. The reason here is that neutrons are, of course, also fermions, also spin 1/2 particles, just like our atoms in two different states, blue and red, are also spin 1/2 particles, if you want. Of course, their interparticle distance is vastly different. Our fermions are roughly a micron apart. The neutrons are a femtometer apart. The density is very, very fluffy for our gases, a million times thinner than air. For neutrons, it's 10 to the 38 particles per cubic centimeter, completely different scale. And therefore, also the Fermi energy is very different. As I said, like 100 picoelectron volts versus 150 megaelectron volts. Yet, the physics is the same, if I'm coarse-graining over details. The scattering length between two neutrons is also very, very large, much larger than the spacing between the neutrons, just like in our case, where the scattering length can be made very, very large compared to the interparticle spacing. So, the equation of state that we measure in our experiment, should very directly relate to the equation of state of dilute neutron matter, as you find it, for example, in the crust of a neutron star. There are details that I'm glossing over. Neutron stars are way more complex than our gases. But say someone came up with a code to explain the neutron star equation of state. Well, then I would ask that person now to switch off all the complications that are related to his neutron star complexities, switch off everything but having spin 1/2 fermions and an absolutely strong interaction. And then I ask that guy, do you get the same equation of state as what we measure in the lab? Because if not, I have a hard time trusting the calculation for the neutron star. Okay, so we put this to the test now. How do we do this? Well, you all know when we climb a mountain, the air gets thinner. You being physicists realize immediately, wait a second, I know the equation of state, roughly, So then I can predict the density as a function of height. It turns out the inverse works as well. If you measure the density of air as a function of height, you can, of course, back out the equation of state. That's precisely what we did. We just measure the density of our atoms as a function of, well, height or potential, if you want. And those atoms in our trapping potential, they're just like the air and the gravitational potential. So this is the picture. This is our trapping potential. Down there in the valley, we are very dense, And for a given temperature, that means we are very degenerate probably. So hopefully we have a superfluid down here. Whereas up here, if you climb the mountain, the air, so to speak, gets thinner, we get normal, and at some point we are running out of atoms. That's what it should look like. So what we have to do is we have to take very precise measurements of the density of our atoms in our trap. So we have to take pictures like these and measure very precisely the density as a function of the potential, as a function of height, so to speak. This is what comes out of a single run of the experiment. I totally admit it looks rather boring. Yeah. What is interesting about that? Well, somehow this curve, as innocent as it may look, must contain the equation of state of our strongly interacting Fermi gas. But how to get it? This is the density. Great, so we measure the density. What about the pressure? Well, the pressure for that climber who climbs up the mountain is the weight per unit area of the air above you. That's what the pressure is. So then it's simple. You just need to integrate the density from where you are up to infinity, and that gives you the pressure. Indeed, that's the formula. You just have to integrate the density over the potential from where you are at point V, say, at potential V, up to infinity, and that gets you the pressure at this point V. Great. We have the density, we have the pressure at each point, we need the temperature. So that's the problem. We cannot, as I said, stick in a thermometer. That's obvious. We could stick in another species of atoms, for example, sodium atoms. We happen to have them around as a fridge for our fermions. I never really told you that we use lithium. I said lithium a couple of times, but I didn't tell you. Lithium 6, turns out, is a fermion. If you count all the elementary particles, it is a half-integer spin particle, so it's a fermion. So we can throw in sodium, for example, and use sodium as a thermometer. It's very tough, though, because they have different masses, so the trap is a little bit different for the sodium. It's really hard. Then the sodium at some point becomes a condensate. That's very bad if your thermometer condenses, right? So that's very difficult. We said, let's not do this. Let's just not do this. It's too hard. Let's instead measure another thermodynamic quantity, the compressibility. Compressibility, that's just the change in the density with the potential. How much more density do you get when you squeeze a little more? That's the compressibility. It's simply related to the derivative of the density with respect to the potential, dndv. So we can directly read it off from our data as the slope of our data. That's the compressibility. Fantastic. So from this one curve, we get three thermodynamic quantities at each point in our trap, and therefore get the compressibility equation of state. In principle, from one shot, honestly, the noise would be too large if you just repeat the experiment once, so we do it 200 times to reduce the noise, and we get a beautiful compressibility equation of state. It turns out that all other thermodynamic quantities follow. That's the power of statistical mechanics. It really pays off to learn statistical mechanics. If you think it's boring, it's unbelievable. It's so powerful. I didn't appreciate that before doing this stuff, to be honest. You appreciate it when you need it. And I so desperately needed it. It was very good to me. So let's figure that out, what we can do with it. First, let me show you the measurement, compressibility as a function of pressure, normalized by the pressure of a non-attracting Fermi gas, P naught, and the compressibility is normalized by the compressibility of a non-attracting Fermi gas, kappa naught. The solid line here shows the compressibility equation of state for a non-attracting Fermi gas. That's why it ends at 1 here, because I've normalized the pressure and compressibility by their value for a zero temperature non-attracting Fermi gas. So clearly, this has to be the last point in that equation. We first actually produced a non-attracting Fermi gas. We can switch off the interactions if you want, and just checked whether our method works. So this is the data. We get these data points. Within the error bar, it seems to work very well. We get the non-attracting equation of state back out from this method. So that provided us with trust that we can trust our method, it works. For the strongly interacting Fermi gas, this is what we measured, the red data points. It's subcurve, whatever it is, here you see there's something interesting, so very likely I should zoom in there, and I will do so in a second. That's what it is. But now let's use the power of StatMac to get other quantities out of it. I admit I did not grow up with the compressibility equation of state. Something what you do learn very early on is what the heat capacity is, right? How much does your energy of your system increase as you increase the temperature a little bit? That's measured by the heat capacity. And I'll tell you that we can now get this heat capacity out of our equation of state. And you will be confused and say, wait a second, you did not measure the energy, you did not measure the temperature. Why on earth do you hope to get the specific heat out of this? But here comes the magic. We need one relation that is true for non-attracting gases, but also our resonant gas, which is, you might have seen that in StatMac, the pressure is related to 2/3 times the energy density. Now, that simply follows from the fact that there is the scattering length has gone through the roof, it's out of the problem, and the only way the energy can depend on the Fermi energy is very directly via the Fermi energy. Let me throw this at you and say, this is true. We can derive it after the talk. But if you believe it, that's great, because then I can plug it into the definition of the specific heat, where I want to know the change in the energy with respect to temperature, which is now equal to the change in the pressure with respect to temperature. And I can properly normalize if I want. Again, I didn't measure temperature, but I can just figure out what this derivative is using just StatMac relations. And I figure out that it's related to the temperature, which I didn't measure, I admit, to the pressure, which I did measure, and to the compressibility, which I did measure. If you look at this equation closely, you realize it is actually a differential equation for the temperature. You have dt down here, and you have t here. So I can solve for the temperature by just integrating this equation. So I have the temperature. It comes out of our measurement as an integral by solving this differential equation. And once I have the temperature, well, I'm done, because I can just plug it in here. I know the pressure, I know the compressibility, I know the specific heat. That's the magic of StatMac. So here comes now the specific heat as a function of temperature for non-attracting Fermi gas. This is what it looks like. At high temperatures, you reach 3.5 kB, as it should be per particle. At low temperatures, the specific heat of a non-attracting Fermi gas goes down linearly with temperature, because only the guys near the Fermi surface still take part in the action. For a unitary Fermi gas, this is what you get from our data directly. It rather follows quite closely the non-attracting specific heat, but there's a huge peak and then sudden drop. And that, for us, is the direct observation of the superfluid phase transition in a thermodynamic quantity as the specific heat. Turns out any so-called second-order phase transition has such a strong rise and fall in the specific heat at the critical point. You know this, well, one knows this for superconductors, turns out, for superfluids. You might have seen curves like this. I mean, in superfluidity, there's this famous lambda point, right? The lambda point of helium, where the specific heat goes up, diverges almost, and comes down again. Yeah? This is what happens at a second-order phase transition. So now we can say what was the critical temperature in these early days where we saw these vortices. The critical temperature is 17% of the Fermi temperature, or Fermi energy, right? This means, remember, for electrons, we had a Fermi temperature of many 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So 17% of that is huge. I can hope, if I make electrons strongly interacting enough, to make a superconductor far above room temperature. And if I'm honest, far above melting temperature of most metals. So, well, we have to tweak things a bit. I have no idea how to make the electrons that strongly interacting, but someone hopefully comes up with it, and that would be fantastic. Okay, so now I can throw at you simply a couple of graphs that you usually want to show if you have measured an equation of state. You want to show the pressure versus temperature. For a classical gas, this should be just linearly related. P equals nkT, remember. For our gas, it's a little bit, well, not quite much linear, but has a slightly different slope. But at low temperatures, there's this little change in slope, which is just coming from the specific heat jump, and then it settles to a low temperature value. Turns out at zero temperature, the pressure has to be some universal number, xi, times the pressure of a non-interacting Fermi gas. There's no other pressure scale involved in this problem. So it has to be some number times the pressure of a non-interacting Fermi gas. That number we determined to be 0.376 with some error bar. We can also get more quantities, the energy, the chemical potential, the free energy, where you see, for example, the chemical potential for a Fermi gas, it would just go quadratically down in temperature. For a superfluid Fermi gas, there's at some point pairing, chemical potential decreases precisely because of pairing and then settles to this universal value, xi, times the value for non-interacting Fermi gas. Don't want to bore you with that, but just showing you the power of STATMAG, that you can get the entropy if you want. The entropy is the measure of how uncertain, you know, it's a measure of the uncertainty with which we know things about the system. We can get it because we know the energy, it's related to the pressure, and we know the chemical potential, we know the temperature. We can just plug in what we have measured and get this curve, the red data, that's from our experiment. At high temperatures, the entropy follows that of a non-interacting Fermi gas. At low temperatures, we see it completely deviates from a non-interacting Fermi gas precisely because it becomes superfluid. And the white squares here are a calculation that people did using a first-order Feynman diagram calculation, which for the entropy looks quite good, but for other thermodynamic quantities is a little bit off, as I will show. This is now to completely swamp you with graphs. It's the last one, but I want to show you that this is really realizing Feynman's idea of a quantum simulator. On this plot, I have our data as red, which shows the density versus chemical potential normalized by the temperature. And I have thrown onto this plot also all kinds of theories that people have cooked up for this strongly interacting Fermi gas. The white squares, again, are a calculation using the first-order Feynman diagram. And here you see, for the density, they're a little bit off, 10% or so. The circles here are a lattice calculation. These points were predictions for the critical point where the gas becomes superfluid. And the blue dots are a new type of calculation which can, turns out, so to speak, calculate all Feynman diagrams at once. It's a pretty beautiful revolutionary technique, I think, that is able to calculate what strongly interacting fermions do. However, they cannot reach the superfluid regime yet, so that has to come at a later time. So here we can say some theories are better than others. We throw out some, we keep others. That's what a quantum simulator should do. It should really allow us to gain confidence in certain theoretical methods and throw out others. We can do the same thing for the pressure. It turns out the pressure, as we saw, is just the integral over the density, so everything is a little bit smoother. And on this very confusing graph, I have also included two experiments, which apparently have some issue here at high temperatures. And this experimental data has some issues at low temperatures. I don't want to go into it, but unfortunately, there are some issues. We know exactly what these guys have done, in our opinion, incorrectly, and we know what these guys have done incorrectly. But that's another story. So now what we are after is more exotic Fermi systems. We want to go away from simple point contact interactions and have more interesting interactions, for example, between molecules that have a little dipole moment attached to them. So now you have fermions that can either repel when the dipoles are aligned like this, or they can attract when the dipoles are aligned like this. So it's an anisotropic interaction between fermions. We hope that that gets us into more interesting, even more interesting superfluid regimes like P-wave superfluids. We can chop our cloud into pancakes, as I said, and therefore look at the behavior of lower dimensional Fermi systems that you encounter all the time in layered superconductors, for example. And we can completely change the dispersion relation of fermions that you would say in free space should be just p squared over 2m, a beautiful parabola. We can mess it up and make the p squared over 2m into a double well in momentum space. Absolutely crazy. Unfortunately, I think I'm running out of time to tell you the story here, but this weird twist that I can generate different dispersion curves and make them actually dependent on spin, that's called spin-orbit coupling. And it is at the heart of topological phases of matter, like topological insulators, for example. So I'm not sure. I think I'm out of time, which my thing says. So I should probably wrap up here. And this is so cute. It tells me when I'm out. And take questions. But first acknowledging my group at MIT. We have three labs, one working on fermionic superfluids, equation of state type of stuff. We work on these fermions that are dipoles, dipolar fermions, with another experiment, Fermi-1. And we have a new experiment where we hope to look microscopically at atoms with single-site resolution, something that is also happening right here in Toronto in Joseph Thiveson's group, where we really hope to not measure all these average quantities of this Fermi gas, but really look locally. What is each atom doing? And maybe play a little bit Maxwell's demon and make them shuffle around and stuff like that. It's going to be a lot of fun. So with that, I thank you for your attention and take questions.